You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. Here in the West, we've long had conflicts about how to manage land. Should public land be used for grazing? Are cows bad for the land or good? Who decides? What are the criteria? Is agriculture compatible with land conservation or not? In the 1990s, there were battles between environmentalists and ranchers that got pretty nasty. But today, there are conversations going on among groups that haven't always talked to each other, and the results are showing us a path forward for conserving land and water and endangered species and all kinds of species, and using the land for economic purposes at the same time. Leslie Allison is director of the Western Landowners Alliance, and they're one of the groups at the forefront of building relationships, having difficult conversations, and coming up with solutions that acknowledge both the urgent environmental crises that we're facing and the fact that people need to do things like make a living and eat. Before we start talking to Leslie, I wanted to let you know that the Western Landowners Alliance is presenting an evening called Stewardship with a Vision, where land and livelihood meet. It's an evening of short films and discussion on the next century of conservation in the West. And it's at 7 o'clock at the Jean Cocteau Cinema in Santa Fe on January 25th. Earlier that day, there's also an event called Legacy on the Land, Compelling Stories and Creative Tools for Land Succession. It's a day in which people can think about keeping working lands going from one generation to the next. That's also on January 25th. For more information on both of those, you can go to westernlandowners.org. Welcome, Leslie Allison.
Thank you. It's delightful to be back with you.
It's great to have you. So how did the Western Landowners Alliance get started?
Well, it's actually got a great origin story, actually. The way it happened was there was a man named Paul Valdick, who was a Texan, and he was a hunter. And he bought a ranch in northwest Colorado because he was interested in hunting mule deer. And yet when he got out to the ranch, he began to observe that things maybe weren't going so well ecologically. He didn't really know much about ecology, but he could see that his aspen trees were not regenerating. He could see there were things that were not right, and he began working with researchers and ecologists to understand what that landscape was all about. And as he did, that journey led him eventually, oddly, to a meeting of the Wildlands Network out in California. And there was a man named Kenyon Fields, who was the conservation strategist for the Wildlands Network, and Michael Soulet, who's often considered the godfather or the grandfather of conservation biology. And what they were working on was a problem that genetically populations that are confined to, say, islands, eventually the genetics is not diverse enough to sustain that population. And the same thing is true in our wilderness areas. So if you have a population of wildlife that's stuck in a wilderness area, because wilderness areas in the continental United States are very much like islands, right? They're on their own. They're isolated areas.
They're isolated because there's like cities and roads and highways.
Exactly.
So they can't, for example, a deer can't migrate a few counties over to mate with other deer.
Exactly. And so certain species in particular that are more confined to those islands sort of have a bad trajectory in terms of their genetics, and that eventually can lead to extinction. So the Wildlands Network has been looking for ways to connect these islands of protected lands in the United States. And they were trying to figure out how private lands could play a role in helping with that connectivity. And Paul said he looked at a map. They were all standing there looking at a map together. And at first he thought they were just nuts. This dream of connecting these wildlife corridors was not likely to happen. But then he realized that his ranch actually made sort of a quarter-sized, you know, hole on that, or a spot on that map.
Like you take a coin.
You take a coin, you put it on the map, and that would be his ranch. You could see his ranch on the on this map. And he realized that there's other landowners out there that have, you know, other types of ranches, you know, different sized ranches. And he likes to talk about that as sort of the nickels, dimes, and quarters. They're different sizes, but if you connect them all together, along with these islands of protected land, you might just be able to start to make a difference in the connectivity of wildlife moving across these landscapes. And so together, they decided to see what could be done about this, and they called a meeting of conservation-minded landowners who shared a vision for a healthier West that could support both agriculture and wildlife populations, a West in which private lands played an increasingly prominent role in conservation of these resources. And I was fortunate enough to end up at that meeting. And at that first meeting, there were over 8 million acres of private and leased public lands under management represented at the table. And so that showed us right away that there was a great interest in this. There are so many landowners across the West that absolutely love the land. It's why they own land. It's why they choose to live in rural places. They love wildlife. They have to make a living out there, or at the very minimum, even if they have plenty of other resources financially, you can't take a loss on a property indefinitely. So there has to be some sort of economic means to keep these landscapes healthy and going. So there's this very large group of landowners across the West that are interested in this. And so we decided to explore the idea of an organization that would be a voice for those landowners and an advocate for those landowners. And we found that there was tremendous interest in it. And so we formed the Alliance.
So these are all people who are interested both in having economically productive land and land that has migration corridors. So as you were talking about, these mammals can mate with one another during mating season. They can go from their summer to winter places, things like that. Migratory birds have a place to stop and so on. And even species that stay in place that might not be migratory are protected.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. While also enabling that land to remain economically productive.
Now, you are an environmentalist. You also worked for many years as a ranch manager. Tell us your story.
Okay, so I grew up right here in Santa Fe and outside of Santa Fe. I had my family had a little in-holding parcel in the National Forest. So as a child, I grew up roaming the mountains, just living in the outdoors pretty much. And during my childhood, logging companies showed up. And one day, the forest that I knew and loved around me was gone. I went up to this one favorite spot, and there was nothing left but stumps, oil filters left on the ground, beer cans every place. And I was devastated by that. And the other thing that I would see is during hunting season, the canyon would fill up with these hunters. And wildlife would be, I'd find wildlife dead and gutted on the side of the road, again, beer cans and trash everywhere. And so for a long time, as a young person, I was very much anti-logging, anti-hunting. I loved the wilderness. I spent most of my spare time as a high school student in the wilderness, trying to get as far away from people as I could. And so I very much have come from an environmental perspective on these things. But when I was in my 20s, I had a unique opportunity to go to work on a ranch in southern Colorado. Some friends of mine had purchased the ranch, and they bought it really to conserve the ranch and to enjoy it and to learn from it. And we had an idea together that taking care of a piece of land really was letting nature do the work as much as possible, restoring it to a condition of wilderness. We did do a grazing operation. Eventually, we had hunts. We did other things so that we could help support that ranch economically. We always tried to do them with an eye to the ecological health, which was ultimately our mission on that place, was to restore that ecological health. But what I learned in that process of managing land is that we arrived at that ranch, as I think so many people arrive to any place out in the country, and we thought it was pristine. We thought the forests were perfect, that they'd always been that way. We thought the stream was in good condition. And what we found was actually it was a managed landscape. It was a landscape that carried the impacts of human beings that went back not just to pre-European settlement, but long before that. It's a fundamentally altered landscape. And the natural processes are not going to be restored, certainly not in our lifetimes. And so that then raises challenging questions. If you're not allowing fire to be back in the system because we can't afford to let fire burn anymore.
Now, this is an important point that some of our listeners may not fully understand. Something that looks like a forest that is a forest is not really a natural forest because we've kept fire out of it, basically because there are houses and buildings nearby.
Correct, exactly. Exactly. So the Forest Service started doing serious fire suppression over a century ago in the West. And so what we call fire-adapted ecosystems are parts of the landscape that through time evolved with fire. And so we have some kinds of trees that it can't, you know, germinate seeds unless there's fire. Certain Douglas fir seeds, for instance, they need to hit bare mineral soil in order to germinate. But if the pine needles basically have built up over years because fire has not cleaned out that forest floor, then those seedlings can never germinate. And so the nature of the forest itself changes. And the little trees that grow up that would have been kept cleaned back a little bit by fire, they grow to maturity. And so suddenly we have forests with thousands of trees per acre, whereas, you know, a few centuries ago in that same landscape, there might have been 50 trees per acre. And of course, it varies all through time, depending on what climate was doing at that point.
I talked to a firefighter a while ago who said it was something like putting 300 straws into a milkshake instead of like six.
Right, right, exactly.
And they're all drawing the same water out of the same ground.
Well, and that's exactly right. And so when we would go in, we didn't want to see logging in there. Logging was the thing that I grew up really despising. But after really learning and being on that ground day after day and working with people closely, I began to see the real importance of managing those forests mechanically. And we also really wanted to bring back fire, so we used prescribed fire a lot.
This was on the ranch that you were managing.
Yeah, this was on the ranch I was managing. And so we did have a logging operation to achieve those things.
You were talking about how all the landscapes that we see are all managed, and if not managed in a conscientious way, they're altered by human beings. Like the forests that you saw that were logged in such a dramatic way when you were a kid, that wasn't managed with the health of the forest in mind. So when we talk about land management, some land is managed well, some land is managed horribly. What's the difference? Like, are there principles that guide the difference between good land management and bad land management?
Yes, I think there are principles for certain, although I would say that, as you pointed out, every landscape is different. And so I don't think you can be prescriptive about how we manage a landscape. And that's one of the challenges we have today, is that our laws try to be prescriptive in those ways, and they can't be. But for example, if you're depleting the soil that is producing whatever it is you're trying to produce out there, if you're depleting the soil health and you're not regenerating that soil health, you're not on the right trajectory. That landscape is going to degrade over time, and eventually that soil will stop producing the kind of plants it did. Eventually the soil will blow away or be eroded off, and you'll lose the capacity of the land to hold water, and a whole spiral can unravel. So I think starting with soil health is one really good principle. You need to be watching soil health, which means that you have to be monitoring what you're doing out there. If you turn cattle out and you're not paying attention to the result on the soil, then you don't know that it's trending in the wrong direction over time. You're literally losing ground. Making sure that our landscapes can retain moisture, precipitation, for example, is really important. So if you increase organic matter in the soil by 1%, you can add 20,000 gallons to that 1 acre. And that's really important in a place like New Mexico in the arid Southwest. So restoring organic matters to the soil for that water retaining capacity is very important. Trying to keep those natural processes intact as much as we possibly can is really important. If you're in a fire-adapted landscape, you should be paying attention to that process. So those are just some of the principles I think you can apply.
One of the things that we have here in the West is a history of basically people, mostly of European origin, coming into the West, coming into the frontier, especially after the train tracks were built, and taking over land that they didn't really understand.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a big part of our legacy out here in the West.
It is. It's a huge part of our legacy. And we're still trying to restore lands today that were hurt a century ago. There used to be, you know, trains that would come into the Southwest and just dump off cattle until the whole landscape was consumed. And then they would move on to the next place. We didn't give a great deal of thought to what logging our forests and taking all of the best trees out could mean for the landscape. We haven't given very good thought to how water depletions of our aquifers might affect the future. And, you know, the great example, of course, is the Dust Bowl. You know, turning that prairie upside down was a tragic mistake. So we've learned some lessons. Sometimes we have to relearn those lessons, but we do keep trying to at least advance the science to help us do better management of these landscapes.
One of the things that I've come across quite a bit when I start talking to people about conservation who are not, for example, involved in regenerative agriculture, let's say, they assume that what you are talking about when you talk about conservation is taking land out of production, not using it for ranching or farming or any other kind of use, and putting it back into its wild state, maybe with some recreation, maybe some science. But what you're talking about is taking working landscapes and doing conservation, doing really high-level conservation on them, but not taking them out of production.
That's exactly right. That's really the heart of our work, is focused on the conservation of working landscapes. And what I think people may not really appreciate, I certainly didn't, even until relatively recently, but imagine just conceptually a map of the West. And in one place you have a wilderness, maybe it's some high alpine peaks, beautiful country. And then someplace else you have a city. In between the city and the wilderness, typically, is what I call the working lands. And these are deeded private lands and leased public lands. These are the multi-use landscapes, and they can be owned by different entities. So, for example, we have the National Forest System, which is a multi-use landscape. The Bureau of Land Management is another multi-use landscape out there. We've got tribal lands, state lands, and then farms and ranches. And these lands are the things that produce our food, our fiber, the wood that we build our homes with, the energy that we depend on, the water resources that bring water to our faucets, our recreational, you know, pursuits. That's what this working land zone in between wilderness and the urban area provides. And it's a peopled landscape. And conservation in that landscape fundamentally has to be different than the type of conservation where we're setting wilderness areas aside. It has to be different because these landscapes support so many different values, and they all have to be balanced against one another, and economics is a really big piece of that whole equation. We have to, in order to manage these landscapes and all those variables under changing climate conditions, changing economic circumstances, we have to be able to adapt and adjust. We have to have flexibility, and in order to do all that, we really have to have positive working relationships with one another. We have to be able to cooperate in these working landscapes. The problem really comes when one interest group wants to see its special interest dominate over the other special interests in that landscape. And that's where we really see a lot of the conflict today. And we're hoping by bringing attention to the need to think differently about these landscapes that we can create sort of a better future in the way we work together.
So interesting about all this is that you've got groups who at one point were kind of enemies, like environmentalists and ranchers, and now you have environmentalists and ranchers working together. Not always, of course, but you've got these groups that might be politically perhaps not voting in the same party, for example. They might be culturally really different in how they move around in the world and see the world. And what I find so interesting about this is that you really can leave those differences at the door, come into the room together or go out onto the land together and really look at the land. What does it need? What are all these different interests? And come up with solutions.
Yes. And that's a story that just doesn't get told enough today, but it's happening all over the West. And there are beautiful examples of that taking place. The Malpai Borderlands Group is one of the great examples. Right here in New Mexico, we have the Chamapeak Land Alliance. We have the High Plains Grass Alliance. We have all kinds of groups across the West working on this together. But the story we hear in the media is always about the Bundys. It's always about conflict. It's not about the cooperation that's actually probably more the dominant situation.
Well, in your film series that is available on the website, westernlandowners.org, in one of the episodes, you feature a rancher named David Spicer, who's in Nevada, and he did a project that conserved a species of toad that existed, that exists nowhere else on planet Earth.
Yes, yes. And that's a great illustration of what's positive and what's possible out there today. So David became aware of the plight of this toad, which is obviously facing extinction if somebody doesn't take action. He was moved to do so, having learned from his grandfather, actually, about the importance of these landscapes to wildlife, not just to agriculture. And so he sparked a movement in his valley to help support this toad and to bring in other kinds of activities. They've got mountain biking trails, for example, to work closely with Audubon and the Nature Conservancy, groups like that, with the USDA NRCS program, that's the Natural Resource Conservation Service program. And he's pulled together all of these partnerships that are both helping that toad survive, but also helping his ranch and his valley prosper. And it's those kinds of win-win stories that are so important. Because the thing about the working lands is that they support not just people, but they really also support the wilderness. They support wild things. They support animals. So we have, for example, up in the Yellowstone Park, there are 7 big elk herds that migrate in and out of Yellowstone National Park every year. In the winter, they go down onto the working landscapes. So in the summer, people are used to seeing them in a protected park area. But in the winter, that's not where they are. They're down on these ranches. And these ranches are vital to their survival. And in fact, 80% of wildlife species depends on private lands for survival at some point in their life cycle. And so these lands are very important to those populations of elk and all the things that come with the elk, the predators that follow the elk, and so forth. So we really have to be thinking about the working lands as supporting both things. And it's not just wildlife for the sake of wildlife. The ecological systems that these working lands are the foundation for support human life on the planet. So it's also self-interest for us to protect those ecosystems.
So this is an interesting example. The ranchers outside of Yellowstone, and these are lands where, as you say, the elk go and the predators that eat the elk go. How are these people, how are these landowners responding to the elk, to that situation?
Well, that's a wonderful community, actually, and was the subject of a great story in National Geographic in last May's issue. But the ranchers are very sympathetic to the wildlife populations there, and they want to be a very positive part of supporting those populations. And they will even tell you that they recognize that grizzlies and wolves have a place in that landscape. The frustration that they have is that there's no upper limit on these things. So how many elk can be moving across their lands? How much of their livelihood does that displace? The elk not only consume forage that livestock might consume, they not only bring predators that consume livestock, they bring brucellosis in that landscape. And that can put those operations into quarantine and shut them down overnight. If they can't make a living in those landscapes, they have no choice but to sell that. And in a place like Yellowstone, those are gateway communities to the biggest park, most famous park in the world. That's just wall-to-wall subdivision. And then absolutely everybody loses. So in order for them to accommodate those wildlife populations, they have to have some way to gain something economically against what they're losing in terms of the agricultural side of that equation. And that's where we struggle. We don't like to have landowners have elk tags to be able to sell. The sportsmen really don't like that model.
Now, what is that model? Can you explain that?
Well, in some states, if you're a landowner and you're supporting an elk population, you're issued landowner tags, hunting licenses that you can sell to somebody, and then they can come hunt on your land. And that's a way you can make a little bit of money off of the wildlife that you're supporting. But that is not a widely accepted model. It happens here in New Mexico. It does not happen in places like Wyoming. And so there's not an opportunity for landowners to do that there. There's no other real compensation for landowners. And there's, again, no upper limit. The wildlife is managed by the state, and the state makes money off of selling hunting licenses and promoting ecotourism. But that rests on the backs of these working landscapes. And so some accommodation needs to be made of that. And then similarly with predators, not all wolves eat livestock. If they did, you wouldn't have any livestock left in places where there are wolves. Some wolves eat livestock. And same with grizzly bears. Most grizzly bears actually are not preying on livestock. And when you get one that does, what you don't want is for that sow, for instance, to become habituated and teach her cubs to do that. You want to be able to manage that particular animal and that particular conflict. But when these species are endangered, you're not allowed to do that. And so that really frustrates the ranchers who are trying to coexist in those landscapes. Now, not every rancher is trying or wants to coexist with wolves, but plenty do. And these are the kind of things where we have to get together and find a solution that can work for both sides of that.
And that's what the Western Landowners Alliance is all about.
Exactly.
What are some of the solutions that you guys have come up with that are working?
Oh, well, that's a great question. So the Endangered Species Act is one place that we're paying a lot of attention right now. We support the Endangered Species Act. We think that's a very important piece of legislation in this country. And none of our members want to see wildlife species go extinct. And we'd like to see populations be healthy and robust and recovered. The way in which the Endangered Species Act is implemented, however, can cause very real problems for ranchers and farmers and other landowners. And here's an example of that. If you're a rancher that does a lot of work to improve the habitat on your landscape, and the result is you have more endangered species, then you're more subject to regulation or litigation. You're more likely to have to remove the livestock or whatever it is that's helping you make a living out there. So you're really hurting yourself economically, potentially, to do that. Now, we still have landowners that are willing and do help species recover despite that fact, but it's hard and it causes a lot of conflict out there. And where the conflict gets the worst is when you have intermixed public and private lands. So I can give you an example in a checkerboarded landscape of private and public. Many ranches are comprised of both. They lease those public pieces of that landscape and they own the private pieces of the landscape. And they ranch across both. Now, if you have, say, a sage grouse, which is, you know, we're trying to keep that off the endangered species list, and you do something to help grow sage grouse on your property, and then the sage grouse gets listed, and the sage grouse on your property step over the fence to the public side of your ranch, now all of a sudden you can be in a position where an environmental group might litigate to have you remove your livestock to protect that. Well, can you imagine being in a checkerboarded ranch and you can't use every other square because the sage grouse that you fostered on one square has stepped over onto the other side, right? So those are the kinds of challenges that landowners are up against in this public-private interface that they're operating in.
What is the solution for that?
So the solution for that, there's been some great progress on that point. And it's, for example, there's something called an assurance agreement. On private land, if you've got an endangered species, you can sign up for an assurance agreement with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And in that situation, you count the number of that species you have on your property today, and that's your baseline. Then if you go out and you do good work to increase that species, and tomorrow you have 10 times the number you had, and then something happens, the result is that you're back closer to your baseline, you're not going to be held liable for that. So there's really little risk in helping species recover if you've got an assurance agreement. The problem with assurance agreements is that they don't extend onto the public land. There's some nuance in the law that doesn't allow that to happen. And so, again, that rancher that gets an assurance agreement on his private parcel, but he's got a checkerboarded ranch, that sage grouse steps across the line, he no longer has that assurance agreement. There are different kinds of assurance agreements that I won't go into in depth, but that's just one example. The problem is that Fish and Wildlife Service is understaffed. It's expensive. It's hard to get an assurance agreement. People wait years to get an assurance agreement. And so we are working to try to expedite that. We want landowners to have access to an assurance agreement readily if they want to help conserve a species. The other thing is, for example, when we do a critical habitat designation, many people view that as a devaluation of their land. And a critical habitat designation can actually happen even if a species isn't there but has the potential to be there. So you might have a ranch where the Fish and Wildlife Service is designated as critical habitat, and then nobody really wants to buy that ranch in the future because it comes with more legal potential constraints on it. And so the reward, again, for having the habitat that could support a species is more legal constraints, potentially, and potential devaluation. So we'd like to see funding support landowners who are in these situations, so that if your land gets targeted as a core recovery area or a critical habitat, that makes you eligible for maybe some kind of funding program, something that would compensate you for having taken such good care of that land that, in fact, it's available to wildlife, and help you manage that land in a way that allows you to support the wildlife that is there or potentially could be there.
You said a moment ago, you were talking about the sage grouse, that you were trying not to get it listed as an endangered species. It's kind of borderline. Mm-hmm. Why would you not want it listed?
Because when you list a species, again, it comes with a bunch of regulations. All of a sudden, you're dealing with federal management of the landscape. It can put a stop to activities out there. So, for example, if the sage grouse gets listed, a lot of energy production stops, potentially a lot of ranching stops in its tracks because the bird now has earned those endangered species protections. If we can recover the bird to the point where it's not in danger of going extinct, now we can continue to manage and work in these landscapes. We can continue to support people economically out there and protect the bird. We can work around the bird's habitat. And so both things can happen together. Once it ends up under the endangered species protection, a lot of options are off the table, and then you get into the really hard conflicts. And in the case of the sage grouse, so much of land in the western United States is in sage grouse habitat that it would have a gigantic impact on the West.
And so in order to have thriving sage-grouse populations in the West, you basically have to manage the land in such a way that it is used properly and that it does provide that safety and habitat for this particular bird. And there are ranchers who do that. There are ranchers who don't do that. There are oil and gas companies that definitely don't do that. I mean, these oil and gas companies are notorious, and mining companies, for messing up the land and going away.
Right. And so over the last couple of decades, the sage-grouse conservation movement, it's considered the largest conservation movement in history. And ranchers and energy companies and state agencies and federal agencies work together side by side to develop these plans to protect the sage-grouse and recover the sage-grouse while allowing these other activities to take place on the landscape. And it was a very hard-won effort that ended up resulting, it was the greatest collaborative effort on wildlife ever, and it ended up resulting in the Fish and Wildlife Service deciding not to list the species. As long as those plans are being implemented, and as long as we see sage-grouse populations recovering, it's all good. If the plans aren't implemented, if the sage-grouse populations continue to decline, then the species will be listed. It's really that simple. There's a lot of debate about those plans. The current administration is reviewing those plans right now. We're really hoping that they will honor the plans that so many people invested so much effort into developing and give those plans a chance to work. Because if they do, this could be a real model for the future. At the end of the day, everybody wants the sage-grouse to recover. That's the goal of these plans. So let's give them that chance.
I think one of the things that's so interesting about the work you're doing, and it's complex and it's hard to wrap your head around, it's hard for me to wrap my head around, is that you have all these different managers. You've got individuals, private industry, you've got the Bureau of Land Management, you've got tribal land, state land, federal land, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife. There have been moments where it seemed like everybody was running in different directions. Meanwhile, there was a lack of staff, as you say. They're terribly understaffed. And at the same time, a kind of almost choking bureaucracy to the whole thing. And that's very frustrating. I've talked to people who were trying to get something simple done, like a land swap, and after 20 years, they said, we withdraw our application because 20 years is too long to wait. And then the bureaucracy says, oh no, wait a minute, we'll get to it, and they still don't. So what does it take to build that cooperation so you're both working toward the same goals and balancing the different goals that different people have?
I think that's one of the biggest challenges we have going forward in time. And I think there's a wonderful model that has evolved in the Western landscape that can help us answer that question. It can be very scary to people who are used to sort of the federal legislative approach to land management. And what it is we call it place-based collaborative conservation. It means that the people in a landscape who live there, who derive their livelihood from that landscape, who know that landscape very well, come together with all the other stakeholders, and they find a solution that fits for that landscape. And as long as the solutions are within the sideboards of good ecology, good management, you know, the things we need to protect out there, as long as we're taking care of those, then allowing those solutions to be organically created in that given landscape makes a ton of sense. And that's why it's working in places like Malpai Borderlands Group or the Blackfoot Challenge. It can be scary to somebody who may not live in that landscape, who feels that their voice is diminished in that. And people are afraid of allowing local control because they think, and sometimes that's going to mean rape and pillage of the landscape. Again, there's circumstances where you need more, maybe more management, more oversight from a government agency. But by and large, people really are, I think, evolving in their thinking about managing these landscapes. And given the chance, they want the landscape to be healthy. They want it to flourish. They want good things out there, and they want to be able to make a living out of it. So we really believe in supporting place-based collaborative conservation as a priority in management.
You've mentioned the Malpai Borderlands Group. What are they doing? What does it look like out where they are?
So this is a group of ranchers, environmentalists, and agency folks that got together in a million-plus acre landscape in the Malpai Borderlands region, which is in southeast Arizona and southwest New Mexico, right along the Mexican border. They got together partly because of fire. They wanted to reintroduce fire to that landscape. They have a huge brush invasion problem there because of the absence of fire. And so they started working with the agencies on prescribed fire. And that grew into other things. They discovered the northern jaguar was there, and begin a project to help support the northern jaguar. They have endangered Chiricahua leopard frogs. So they're working to support the Chiricahua leopard frogs and endangered fish in little tiny wetlands that they've got in that landscape. And they're also implementing conservation easements. Many of the ranchers there have put conservation easements on because development is really a threat as Arizona grows. And so they're protecting that landscape in that way. And then they're working together to find ways in which ranching and wildlife can coexist. And there have been challenges, you know, when they wanted to do prescribed burn, there was a question about whether it would hurt a certain bat out there. And so they got together with the scientists, they all worked on it, and they figured out that no, in fact, it was just fine for them to burn. So that's the way in which they're trying to manage that landscape across boundaries collaboratively.
You talked a moment ago about conservation easements. Just tell people really quick what those are.
So a conservation easement basically is when a landowner agrees not to develop their land in the future. And usually that's permanently. When you own a piece of property, it's like owning a bundle of rights. One right you have is to build houses on it. One right might be to farm it. Another right might be to develop the minerals on it. So if you think about it as a bundle, what you're doing is selling one part of that bundle. You're selling it or donating the right to put houses on that land.
And you might get a tax credit.
And you can get an IRS tax credit or a state tax credit for that. Or in some cases, you can actually get paid for that because there's a very real value. And it's as much as 30, 40% of the value of your land as its development potential that you're giving up when you do that. So you can get compensation for that. But what it does is it means that no matter who owns the land in the future, they also can't develop houses on it. So it guarantees that that land is going to stay open in the future.
And one of the things that happens with that is it reduces the value of the land because those development rights are gone. You're not going to have subdivisions on it. What you get in return is those wildlife corridors we were talking about earlier. They remain open. That land remains agricultural land. There's so many people, so many young people now who want to go into farming and ranching. They don't have land. They can't buy land. They can't afford it. This keeps prices perhaps even low enough for somebody to actually at some point buy that land. Young people who want to start out, because there's so many ranchers, and I was noticing this while watching your films, a lot of those people are older and their kids don't necessarily want to stay on the land. And then other people who do want to work the land don't have a place to go.
That's true. And succession, the succession in these landscapes is one of the most important issues in the West today. We're about to face a very big change in land ownership in the West. And we have young ranchers and farmers who would like to get out there and work in these landscapes, like you say, who can't afford to buy land. And we have folks that have no one to give their land to in some cases, or their kids just don't want to come back and manage that land. So we're holding a succession forum here in January to really try to tackle that issue a little bit.
And that's January 25th here in Santa Fe. People can get more information about that at the Western Landowners Alliance website. Listening to you, it seems like one of the things that you and so many others tackling these problems need to do is you have to basically become diplomats. I mean, you have to talk to so many different kinds of people with so many interests and work it out without storming out of the room or whatever. I mean, somebody who's not involved in that kind of work might think, okay, a ranch manager would be managing the land, managing the sale of whatever they're producing. But now there's so much more to it than that.
There is. And the way that we really approach that challenge that you're bringing up about all these different people is pretty simple, actually. And it's that we believe that most people have a lot of things in common. There's about 80% of things that we all have in common and about 20% of things that we disagree on. And so if you start by working with what you have in common and you build out from there and you build trust and you build relationships, it's a lot easier to tackle those more difficult questions. So if I sit down to a table with you and I don't know you, but I know that you support the Endangered Species Act and somehow that act is hurting me, I might see you as my enemy. But if we sit down to a table together and we've been friends for years, that conversation is going to be a completely different kind of conversation. And that's really the angle at which we approach this.
The other piece of it is the incredible complexity of the work itself, because you're working in a really complicated context, not only ecological, but also economic, bureaucratic, and whatever illusions anybody might have had about the simple life on the land, it's not like that.
No, it's not. And it's really amazing how much complexity there is. As a ranch manager, I was astonished. The number of skill sets you have to have today, from really being able to understand the legalities of water rights to public relations to how to run a bulldozer or a chainsaw to how to manage a grazing operation to how to deal with forestry, fire, all of those different things is really quite impressive. And it's also complex in the world of policy. And that's where it becomes, in our sort of attention deficit age, our Twitter age, very difficult to explain some of these concepts in a way that people can understand. There's no easy, simple solution on these landscapes. And yet, today, we sort of mistake rhetoric as being real information. And that's where people tend to advocate and be involved in what they support politically and what they support, you know, philanthropically. And so the big challenge is how to have a complex conversation about complex landscapes and complex challenges in today's world.
Where does the reality of climate change fit into the work that you do at the Western Landowners Alliance?
Well, there's a clear reality to it. I mean, you can go out on any ranch in the United States and see the reality of that. Things are changing. Our snowpacks are going away earlier in the season. Lots of different things are changing out there, and ranchers and farmers know that as much as anybody. And I think there's great concern about it. There's not obviously consensus everywhere on the source of that climate change or the extent or what it implies for us. But I think as a whole, our community is very deeply concerned about climate change and feeling the direct effects of it. Our work, however, doesn't try to address climate change in the sort of the really big picture way of, you know, globally, what are we going to do about climate change? But it really tries to address it at the ground level, the places where people actually can make a difference. And it's going to be the same work we talked about earlier in terms of what are the good principles of managing these landscapes, because two things are important here. One is, given climate change, these landscapes need to be more resilient. That means they have to be healthy. That means the soil has to be good and the water retention capacity has to be good. So to survive climate change, we have to have healthier landscapes. The second piece is that healthier landscapes sequester more carbon. And there are lots of people that look to agriculture as a part of the solution for global climate change. If you've got less bare ground, you're sequestering more carbon in your landscape, and that's a good thing. If our forests are not going up in gigantic wildfires, that's less carbon in the atmosphere, and that's a good thing. So working on healthy lands is the same as working to fight climate change, and that's really our approach to it.
What are you working on now? What are your current challenges?
So we work in three different areas, really. We work on policies. We work on sharing knowledge with one another so that we can improve our stewardship on the ground. And then we work on telling the story so that it helps inspire others who are interested in land management and also helps the public understand really what's happening on these landscapes. So those are the three areas we work in. And on the policy arena right now, we're focused very much on the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill is up for renewal later this year, and that's a very important piece of legislation. I think people can't fathom how big of an impact that has all over the United States. And there's a piece of the Farm Bill that's called the conservation title, and that conservation title provides funding to help ranchers and farmers improve these landscapes, improve the water resources that we all depend on. We really, really need to see that conservation title continue to be funded and available in the West. We'd particularly like to see more of that Farm Bill focus in the West. It's often been more focused in the Midwest, but New Mexico is a huge recipient of Farm Bill funds. And so Farm Bill is a big focus for us. The Endangered Species Act is on the table because there are a number of people in Congress and around the West who are trying to reform the Endangered Species Act. And again, we support the Endangered Species Act and also agree that there's ways that we can improve the implementation so that we've got more buy-in, more support, and that we actually get those animals, those species, recovered more quickly, so that they can be delisted. And that, most importantly, that we're managing in a way to keep these species off the list to begin with. As long as we're fighting in that 11th hour before an animal goes extinct, that's a terrible place for us to be. We need to be ahead of that curve. And that means we've got to have public cooperation and investment in these landscapes on which these wildlife depend. So we're working hard on that particular point, too, on policy. We're working on a property tax thing that would allow landowners in New Mexico to manage for natural resource objectives that the state has, better water resources, healthier forests, things like that, and that would also allow people who used to be in agriculture but can't farm or ranch anymore to be able to afford to keep their land so that they can stay in their own communities and pass land on down through generations. So that's another big policy piece. And then on the stewardship front, we spend a lot of time out on the ground on ranches, bringing people together so that they can learn from one another. And then finally, our communications, our films, is an example of our storytelling.
The films are produced in partnership with Montana State University's Graduate Program in Science and Natural History Filmmaking. And we haven't talked that much about the films themselves, but they're really good. I mean, they're beautifully produced, and they paint a picture that includes not only the people on their land and stories of restoration, successful conservation projects. And there's different examples about water conservation, creeks, animal species, lots of different things. But the other thing that's really beautiful is you see where these folks live. You hear the voices of the animals themselves, the birds and the elk. They're just wonderful films, and they are available on the website, westernlandowners.org. And people can also go to see them. If you are listening to this and you are in the Santa Fe area, you can go to the Jean Cocteau Cinema on the 25th of January at 7 o'clock in the evening and see all of these films and have a discussion about them. Leslie Allison, I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community, and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.